So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Tuesday, we head to the battlefields of medieval Spain to witness the very first ambulance.
On Wednesday, it's the anniversary of the day Coca-Cola's creator hit on his winning formula. He dropped the wine, but kept the cocaine.
On Thursday, the thief who stuffed the crown jewels down his trousers.
And on Friday, when free-spirited Danish parenting put 90s New York in a tears.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, Man fans. Ollie Mann here with The Modern Man. Hello to Graham, who says, I was listening to your interview with Andrew Ramroop last week and I got a strong autosensory meridian response. Google it if you don't know what that is. Well, I have Googled it, Graham. And as far as I can see, it's basically a spine tingle, or some say a brain orgasm. And you're not the only one who felt it seems. Andrew's soft Trinidadian tones did it for a lot of you. Michael tweeted at The Modern Man to say Andrew has a voice like melted butter. Mark said Andrew has the most relaxing podcasting voice. So I'm glad you enjoyed last week's show. You probably won't get as much of a spine tingle this week, because if you listen very carefully during the Foxhole and Zeitgeist segments, you can actually faintly hear the sound of bagpipes, which is more likely to induce nausea, I should think. It's because we were recording in a trendy central London location, exactly the kind of place you'd expect to find hip kids like us. Good coffee, trendy soft furnishings, upcycled from Shoreditch, that kind of thing. But directly outside the bar, there was a bloke playing bagpipes for tourists. So sorry if you do detect that in the background faintly. We only had an hour to record, so there you are. It is well worth battling through, though, because our feature interview this week, oh my God, it is an absolute stonker. I am actually excited for you because I know what's coming up and you don't. It is one of the standout conversations of this series. It's a cracking real life story. And I must say, I'm so pleased to say this as well. We found it thanks to you. Man fan Russell wrote to me back in March. He said, Ollie, my brother met an amazing guy whilst working offshore in the oil industry. An unassuming chap called Bill, with quite the fascinating story to tell. The book he was reading at the time was written by his good friend Gavin. He claimed it was all about the two of them and their amazing journey some years previously. It's even been made into a film called The Great Hip Hop Hoax. However, the story is still little known and well worth your attention. Well, Russell, following your email, I watched the movie. It is an amazing feature-length documentary from a few years ago about these two guys who basically blagged a record contract. One of them, as you say, was Bill, who your brother met. The other is a guy called Gavin, and that is who I'm interviewing this week. It is an amazing story. He's an amazing talker. Before we get on with the episode, though, may I just take a moment, to remind you that although this show is free to download, it is not free to produce. Like I say, we've been working on just this episode since the spring. So obviously it takes our time and costs money. We only recoup a little bit from advertising. So if you enjoy the podcast, please support us. You know the deal by now. We call it beer money because the average cost of a pint of beer in Britain is £3.47. And that is how much we ask you to donate to us per month. Just one pint of beer to support our show and keep us on air. But you can send us any amount of money you want, as little or as often as you like. It's all secure. Just visit modernmanwith2ns.co.uk/beer. Because if you'd buy us a beer in real life to say thank you, do please buy us a virtual one. Right, this week you will learn how to jump the queue at Pineapple Studios. You'll learn which day of the week is the worst to ask for a pay rise. And you'll learn what muffing is. Let's go. On this week's Modern Man.
This is real fraud. It's not a jokey fraud. Like, we will go to jail.
Fake names, fake accents, and real talent. A dangerous combination for wannabe pop stars.
Three vibrators and a stainless steel G-spot probe.
and Alex Fox delivers a happy finish for a listener with a phobia of semen. But first, it's that hit and miss bit about trends with Ollie Pitt. Hello.
Hit and miss.
I think that's fair. What have you got for us this week?
Well, Tomavom.
What?
Tech companies, Ollie, have been making good on their promises recently, which is something that only a few weeks ago I said that they weren't. Elon Musk has delivered his battery to Australia in 63 days when he said it would take 100. And Uber...
What do you mean delivered his battery to Australia? What does that mean?
He basically supplied them with a ginormous battery and he said, if I don't deliver it within 100 days, you get it for free. He delivered it in 63. And I said he doesn't keep his promises and there he is keeping his promises.
Supplied who? The government of Australia?
The government of Australia.
Why do they need a big battery from Elon Musk?
This isn't the story.
No, I know, but I'm just... You just dropped it in like everyone's talking about that. Oh yeah, Elon Musk and his Australian battery voyage. I mean, what are you on about?
Exactly the same reason anybody else would want a battery. They need power. Anyway, Uber as well are over-delivering. They have just ordered 24,000 Volvo XC90s, which are going to be fully autonomous, and they're having them delivered from 2019 to 2021, right?
Over-delivering perhaps for their customers, maybe not so much for their drivers.
So now the reality is sinking in.
Mm.
Uber think that you are going to puke in their nice, swanky new cars.
Oh, because I'm not used to being driven without a driver and I'll find it... What?
Well, if you're not having to drive a car, what you're probably going to be doing...
Get motion sickness.
Exactly that.
But you don't on a train.
Yes, because a train's going in a straight line. So the problem with autonomous cars is they drive like autonomous cars. They're quite robotic in their movement. Mm. You can't anticipate where they're going to go. A train's very fluid, very, you know, nice and straight. Same with an aeroplane.
So hold on. The trend that you're trying to bring to my attention is Uber think I'm going to puke because of motion sickness. That's the trend. No? There's
Uber,
more? How long is this foreplay?
Uber have filed a patent for a sensory stimulation system for an autonomous vehicle. It's a seat that detects the movement of a vehicle and then, like, blasts air conditioning in your face. It vibrates it. It moves it in certain directions to stop you puking in their fancy cars.
Is it a patent to put a telly in the back of a car? You know, it's always a seat that combats your motion sickness, yes, but I bet it has a telly in the back of it and I bet they put ads on it.
As you know, I research this section in depth every single week.
Thoroughly. Hours in the British Library you are, aren't you?
Here,
if anyone ever wants to find you, that's where you'll be.
Here I have the patent.
Oh, right,
I have been
okay.
through it. I understand none of it.
Yeah.
It's mostly flowcharts. But what it illustrates is that, no, it's not a TV in the back of a seat, because that's the problem. If you were to just sit and watch Netflix whilst your car's driving you around the streets or whatever...
There's no if about it.
Well, yeah,
it's
but you're going to be sick. I'm sick if I read a book in a car.
Yes. What else have you got for us this week?
Dead Social. Death, Ollie. It's coming to all of us, whether you like it or not. And
that is a persistent trend.
It is. And our way of sort of dealing with it when we lose a loved one currently is to put a suit on, go to a crematorium, listen to Coldplay, and eat some cucumber sandwiches.
Sure.
Whilst holding back tears the whole time.
Yes.
But that's going to change.
Is it? Yeah.
Right now. Motherboard are saying that we're going to change the way that we grieve, because there are these social
apps.
Who's
Motherboard?
Motherboard are a subsidiary of Vice.
Oh, okay. You know, I'm not cool
Vice
enough.
Media.
I know what Vice is.
Yeah.
I'm just not cool enough to know what Motherboard is, but now I do.
So they think that we're going to change the way that we grieve, because there's these social apps and sites that allow you to set up posts now, whilst you're living, that your family and friends will see after you die.
I get that in the old days, as in maybe as recently as now, you would choose to, for example, write a letter to your daughter so that she can open it in 10 years' time and you say everything you would have said if you hadn't died tragically of cancer. That's quite a nice thing to do. It's a possession they can hold on to. It's personal and intimate. It means something to them. And although to our generation it seems odd that you'd do a digital version of that, I guess that's the way we're going, isn't it? And if you wanted to time an email or even a Facebook post saying how much you loved your daughter for 10 years hence, I guess that's maybe a nice thing to do. But what you're suggesting sounds like you'd put your sort of, you know, your comical observations about everyday life. Oh, I was a bit busy on the train today. You'd schedule those for years after you die, and that's just fucking weird.
But my big gripe with it isn't so much that. It's just that one of the best things about being dead is you don't have to do anything. You're just giving yourself...
No one can poke you.
You're giving yourself all of that work to do.
No one does that anymore, do they, by the way?
Poking?
Poking on Facebook.
Does it even exist?
I don't know if it... I bet it does.
You can't poke the dead. You'd get done if you start doing that. And also... Surely it just makes the grieving process much, much longer.
That said, though, do I quite like the idea of still being able to podcast after I'm dead?
I don't think anybody else does.
Because you could say all the things you couldn't say when you're alive, couldn't you? Be honest about everything.
What if it got out before you died, though?
Yes, well, that's the difficulty.
Yeah,
hacked.
And then you were like, You were saying all these horrible things
about
people.
No, everyone knows I'm a necrophiliac or whatever, yeah.
Oh.
Sorry, that just came into my mind because we're talking about death. I'm not actually a necrophiliac.
Sure, because that's on the record.
I'm fairly sure about that, yes. I don't think you forget about it. It's that moment of the show where we catch up on how you have been faring in your quest to become a true trendsetter. Last week, Man Fan Dave challenged you to take 30 minutes each day to do something purposefully to relax. He thought you sounded tense.
Yes.
You don't look tense today, so maybe it's been working. What have you been doing?
So, on the first day, right, I had a bath.
You probably fit in an average-sized bath, don't you?
Well, I'm assuming my bath is an average size, and yes, I do fit.
Yeah, because I can't submerge myself fully in a bath unless it's, I think, 1,800 long, which is ridiculous.
1,800?
So if you say, occasionally, oh, right, I'll stay in, like, a really nice hotel and they have a huge bathtub, sure, and I can fit in, but it needs to be one you'd, like, drown someone in. That's the only thing. Otherwise, I have cold bits.
Yeah, I can fully submerge myself in this bath.
And well, gel.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Did you go full Sex in the City? I mean, did you have, you know, some relaxing music on the stereo, perhaps a glass of white wine in your hand?
Did have music going, yes. Yeah.
What was it?
No wine.
Yeah.
Oh, just Spotify playlist.
Right, yeah, but of what, Ollie? I don't care about the mechanic.
What do you mean of what?
What were you listening to try and relax?
Yeah, just a Spotify playlist.
Of what? Relax. A Spotify playlist of what? If it's Slipknot, it's not that relaxing, is it? I'm just trying to get a sense of what
oh,
you're
right.
listening to.
Oh, I got it. Don't know.
You
I
don't
remember.
Know. It's all just music. On. Hey, it's well, all just, it is. It's all ones and zeros,
that's
isn't it,
problem.
Music?
That's the problem with Spotify. I never remember what I was actually listening to. All I know
right,
is
fine,
it was
whatever.
Very relaxing.
Okay, so it was quite relaxing. Okay, what did you do on day two? Something more exciting, I hope.
It's stressing me out. I meditated.
Oh, good. Okay. Have you ever done that before?
I have, and I've used this app before, but I thought I'd give it another go because the first time I used it, I was a bit like, it's an app called Headspace. Have we spoken about it?
I'm not sure we have, but I've read about it before, and it seems like a trendy thing.
It's basically a meditating app that you just whip out, and you can just meditate at any given moment. And it basically says, you know, like if you want to train, you could use it. You just sort of, you know, listen to your surroundings and close your eyes and all that kind of stuff. But they're in 10-minute chunks, so I did a few of these in a row. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fine.
Day three. What?
Well, you're so disinterested.
I'm not all
the
day,
whole
mate.
Point of, the whole point of this, I'm going out trying to find out how this stuff works, and then you just spend all this effort downloading
did.
The app, listening to this bloody meditating
we
thing, this bloke chatting side listening,
review.
And then
you just
dismiss it.
I'm not dismissing it.
Fine.
I heard what you said. I'm asking what you did on day three.
Gave myself a hand massage.
What do you mean a hand massage? You mean you massage your own hands?
Well, I found a listicle online.
Yeah.
Top 40 ways to relax. And it was like number 37, so I thought I'd give it a punt.
Yeah.
Not worth it.
What did you Why use?
I use my hands.
No. Oh, God, this like Spotify playlist again. I mean, what materials did you use? Was it like, you know, sunflower oil or what?
No, just moisturiser.
Right.
Just moisturiser on the hands. Uh-huh. I'm not buying any special massage oils. And the point is, they say, look, you know, you use your hands
still
all the time.
Still sounds angry, doesn't he? Doesn't sound like he's relaxed at all.
I was relaxed until I walked in here. You start challenging me about my relaxing process.
Day four.
I used another app.
Yep.
Called Calm.
Okay.
This was a suggestion from somebody on Twitter.
Someone you haven't had the courtesy to remember the name of.
Jables.
Brilliant.
No, appreciative.
You're appreciative. You just couldn't be bothered to remember her name and read it out in the show.
They got a thing called Sleep Stories, and they have one on there that's read by Stephen Fry. And the story is called Blue Gold. And he basically describes a scene of lavender fields in Provence. And it was amazing.
Was it? Was it good?
Yeah, genuinely.
So far, that's 5 stars, right? Everything else, 4 or 3.
Yeah. I've had dreadful sleep. This thing, it just knocked me out. I can't even remember the rest of the story. Something about lavender.
Do you pay for Calm?
No, you don't. You can download it to start.
It's got an in-app purchase, hasn't it?
I bet it bloody
has.
Of course it has. Yeah. If you want another Stephen Fry story, you got to pay for that.
I bet you have, yeah.
It's like $2.99 a month or something.
What did you do on day five?
I did nothing for 30 minutes.
Okay.
Just do nothing. It's a thing. Do nothing for
but
30 minutes.
But not consciously meditate.
Nope, just do nothing.
So, right, consciously do nothing or just don't consciously think of anything?
Just do nothing, Ollie. It's not complicated.
Right, yeah.
You just do nothing. And
but does that mean what? Sitting down, standing up, in the garden?
Well, this is my point. I don't rate it because you're never not doing nothing. You can't
you're
not do nothing.
Never not doing nothing. Yeah. I can't handle that. That's three
exactly.
negatives in a row.
That's already confusing.
So what were you doing when you were doing nothing?
I was sitting on the sofa with my legs crossed, sitting there like this, thinking, I've got stuff to do. Why am I doing this?
Yeah. Day six.
I drank green tea and a honey tea instead of coffee.
Ah, so interesting.
Over the, you know, I know it's 30 minutes a day, but that's a conscious sort of decision.
Yes, sure.
Yes.
And What did you make of it? Because I definitely feel the effect of too much coffee. I get sort of antsy.
Drinking green tea is like eating celery. It's pointless. I think that it's nice, but you don't get anything out of it. Drinking coffee, I love coffee.
Yeah.
At least you get something from it. It engages your brain. It just makes you feel amazing. Drinking green tea is just like...
Well, it's just a limperisted carrot tea, isn't it?
You can go mocking my carrot tea.
Day 7, the final day of relax.
I spent some time cooking.
That's interesting because I've been watching a lot of food programmes. There's a lot on, aren't there, just before Christmas because all the cookbooks come out.
Of course.
And Nigella, when she's like doing something that's actually like everyone knows is really frustrating, like having to chop up carrots,
mm-hmm.
she says things like, it's so delightfully soothing. She says things like, I could just do this all day. It's just so relaxed. And I'm thinking, like, no one enjoys that.
Now, I had people coming over the following day. So what I did is I decided the day before, do this. So I set aside 3 hours to do it and cook mm-hmm. it. It was a vegetarian lasagna.
Mm-hmm.
Just chill out, grate in some cheese, stick it in the oven.
Yes.
Sit down whilst it's cooking.
Okay, let's cut to the chase here.
Yeah.
The best one then was the Calm app.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay,
I recommend
done. Right, let's talk about your challenge for next week.
Brilliant.
And let's pass you the envelope.
Should be another week of de-stressing, hopefully. Your challenge this week is from John, who says, watch as many previews as possible and review them for us next week.
Oh, okay.
Previews of what?
That's all he said. I presume he means TV programmes, but I guess if you can blag your way into a film screening or perhaps even
I'm
a shopping extravaganza.
Like,
so all you need to do, basically, is write to some press offices and say, I'll talk about it on the show. Tell me what the next big three shows are you've got coming up. That's good. That's nice.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
Our listeners are writing
to
nice
press
things
people.
For you to do.
I don't want to do that.
Sure, I get that. But listeners don't think like that. They just think, let's reward Ollie with something nice. They could. In fact, you could, listeners. These are genuine suggestions. You could go to modernman.co.uk and click on feedback and say, what I'd really like Ollie Pitt to do is sit in a bath full of cold beans for 2 days. And we'd put it to him. But you haven't. You've given him nice things to do.
That is a nice thing. Thanks, John.
Right, there we go.
I will, again, enter into this with full enthusiasm.
Great. Okay.
Becoming a catchphrase.
Hello, Man fans. My name is Emily Burt. I'm a business journalist at People Management Magazine, and these are my top 3 Squarespace life hacks for how to get a pay rise. My first tip is do your prep. So think about when you're going to do this. Don't do it on a Monday at the beginning of the week because everyone is very stressed on Mondays. Don't do it on a Friday either because everyone's winding down. You're not thinking that professionally. But also just be smart. Choose a time when they're going to be focused, but they don't have too much on and they've got the time to sit down and listen to you. And just do your preparation. You know, dress well, dress for the job that you want. And do ping them over an email in advance to let them know what you want to talk to them about. So they've got a bit of advance warning and they have some time to think themselves about the proposition that you want to make. Tip number 2 is to know your worth. If you want a pay rise, it stands to reason that you think there's a reason for that. So when you go into this meeting, be prepared to lay out several practical reasons about why you deserve this raise. Have you been going above and beyond your job description? Do you feel like you've been excelling? And can you provide hard evidence for that, just to back up your request? Another thing that you can do is you can always benchmark yourself. There are lots of websites where you can look at how your pay is compared to other people in your field, although I must stress that you should never go in and ask for a pay rise just because you feel like you deserve it because other people are getting paid more than you. So you've got to be able to make a good, strong case if you're going to get that raise. My third tip is to go in there with the right attitude. You should be able to be confident and assertive without coming across as aggressive or challenging when you ask for a pay rise. Research from Cass Business School shows that women ask for pay rises just as much as men do, but they're far less likely to get them because they are not assertive enough in making a case for themselves and are far more likely to back down when they are given a no. If you do get a no from your boss, you shouldn't just walk out of the door. You should also treat this as an opportunity. Ask for feedback, ask what you can be doing better, and just really demonstrate that you are keen to be going above and beyond your potential. So those are my top 3 tips for getting a pay rise. You can find much more about pay information and lots of other interesting business journalism at peoplemanagement.co.uk. So what are you waiting for? Go out there and make it happen.
Thanks to Emily for her Squarespace life hacks.
Remember, you can share your own expert advice in minutes by building your blog with Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code MAN, that's M-A-N-N, to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Now, did you have a musical tribe at school? you know, perhaps you were a goth, perhaps you were really into grime or punk. Well, for Gavin Bain, it was hip-hop, which was common enough where he grew up in South Africa. But when he was 10, his family moved to Scotland, where he stuck out like a sore thumb and was bullied at school. He wanted to be a rapper, but it wasn't until he went to college, his first day of college, in fact, that he met anyone else who shared his interests. His name was Bill.
He was he was just this weird-looking dude. Good-looking, really good-looking, but he had these massive-ass jeans dragging across the floor, a chain, like a dog chain, going past his knees. He had these cornrows in his hair. Right, and then he had like a Hanson t-shirt on. It was just like, whoa. And that's why I stopped, because I was walking past him and I knew I was late. And he's like late and doesn't care. I'm late and like for first day of college. And I'm just like, oh man, you know, I don't, this is going to be embarrassing now. I got to walk in there. And I just looked and I saw the Hanson t-shirt and I was like, stopped and looked back. And he just kind of dismissed me. He was just like, I don't know, go away. You know? And I just like walked past him. I'm like, what the fucking dickhead. And then I walked around to school, got lost, and eventually got brought back to this other class, walked in, sat down at a table at the only space left, and it was right next to him. We just started talking about movies, our favorite movies, quoting lines from our favorite films, and just we created a rap group in probably by the second period of, you know, second lesson. It was like, do you want to be in a rap group? It was like, yeah, I think I do.
What were you called?
We were called B Production, which wasn't a really good name considered, but we were like, oh, your surname's B, my surname's B, let's call it Production. We were doing it in American accent because to us it was like, what, how else are you going to do it?
Like Elton John sings in a kind of transatlantic.
In the same way everyone, in the same way all the Scottish singers till that point had sung, in the same way Annie Lennox sounds, yeah, American, and Sheena Easton or Marty Pello, you know, all these people, they sing, and but rap's very different. Each place took it on as, this is our rap.
There isn't really a Scottish grime still that's cut through.
No,
there,
there's a sound for sure. It's just very, very lo-fi and very grimy. And the storylines are very dark because it is an oppressed people in many ways. You know, like you can't live in the central belt of Scotland and not deal with depression or real hardcore shit.
Okay, so you were rapping in American accents. What were you rapping about together?
We were doing a lot of funny stuff because we were very funny, and we were acting characters. We were playing scenes. We liked to act together. We were like a comedy duo. And it was, and then some dudes came along and said, now you can't do that. You can't rap like that here.
Can't rap like what?
Like American and that sense of humor and that style.
It's not authentic.
It's not. You're cheating. But they were way better than us, and they had their shit together. So we were like, all right, well, I guess he's right. And so we started to go into Scottish accents. But the thing with me is that I when I came to the UK, I had a South African accent. Mm. I got beat up a lot, so I had to learn how to speak a Scottish accent. Mm. So then I was putting on an extra Scottish accent to be cool now with Scottish rappers. So it was playing further roles. Yeah. You think you are shit? My flow is cool like diarrhea. Spit more in one verse than Morse whole entire career. I got more range than people that live in South Korea. Head like an encyclopedia, I'm always thinking of ideas. I got more range than drugs in a pharmacy. Last 3 years, master's speech of a massive vocabulary. I got more fatness than the actress was on. More beats programmed and more lines like slogans. Move a package delivered than a postman. No slow jam, sorry kid. Too much of a showman. I rock more spots than pimples on your ugly mug. Is he A, C, D? None of the above. Simply be as that rugged stuff none other can touch. From further up in the UK, shitting down, much love. We spent like about a year doing everything, battling and toured everywhere, done everything we could do in Scotland. We had made these six songs. We had saw this this thing that said online that said, are you the next Eminem? Because Eminem had just broken. Mm. And it was kind of upsetting for us because, holy shit, this guy's doing our thing. We jumped on a bus. It was a 13-hour bus journey down, which we got wasted the entire way. Slept maybe an hour. Got off the bus, made our way to Covent Garden. It was in Pineapple Studios, which is just outside, you know, Covent Garden down to your right. But the queue went around the block twice. So we tried to skip in. People were like, fuck off, you're not skipping in. We just said, well, we'll battle you for your spot. I think between us, we must have battled about 80 people, you know, before we ended up right down the front. I think we were the second or third group in. We had that mentality of like, this is for us. We're here. I understand you all want to get in there, but we're here. This is for us. Get the fuck out of the way.
Did you get the impression that everyone else that had responded to that ad then were just trying to tap into a trend?
There were so many people who weren't rappers.
They hadn't put the work in yet. And that's how you saw it.
And it wasn't, and I say like we battled our way through probably 80 people odd. It wasn't that hard. It wasn't like a Don't Flop or a, you know, King of the Dot battle. It was pretty easy because everyone was so shit. And we walked in and we stood on our little spot. I guess this was just before, I mean, maybe Pop Idol was on, but it was that kind of, that format, it comes from that. Auditions always were like that. So three judges, A&R panel, and you know, we're told to stand on our spot. And it's like, immediately it just feels like, what the fuck is this? And then we give our CD across, press play, we're not ready. And it's like, oh shit, sorry, no, put it back. So I come in straight away, you've got to put it back, you know. It's like already, it's like all over the place. Like, fuck man, don't just head it on. But they don't have time. So they're just like, come on. We must have done about 30 seconds of just lyric, cutting each other off. And there was the three of us. There was my other best friend, Oscar Bravo. He was also doing it with us. And we were just weaving out of each other, 30 seconds of just like, it was going well. It felt good. And then they were just, I kind of started to see the kind of laughter breaking on the faces and kind of, and that was just like, whoa. And I'm starting to like not think of the next line. And we're kind of, it's breaking us, you know, it was breaking our vibe, you know. And then they kind of stopped us, like gave us that whole, haven't you seen MTV? Like, don't you know the culture? Don't you know? What is this? Is this a joke? The thing is, you're from Scotland. You're Scottish. It's not going to work. It's never going to work. We are never, ever going to be looking for something like that. We wanted a second opinion, so we went to a really hardcore, well-known UK label, Word Lab, who had just done Mark B and Blade and real, like, you know, good artists. And we knew there's no way we're going to get in. So we basically waited for the post guy. And as he kind of opened the door, we went in with him. And we went up to the first floor. And then we were like, ah, Dave. We had a meeting. We're supposed to meet. And we just convinced him that we had a meeting with him. He's like, no. I was like, Dave, we've taken a 13-hour bus journey down. Like, come on. It will be half an hour. And we kind of was like, all right, come on in. He sat us down. He was like, all right, let me hear your stuff. Puts it on. He's like, no, skips the next track. No, skips the next track. No, skips the next track. Goes through five tracks. There's one more. He's like, yeah, I get it. Pulls it out. So throws it back. He's like, nah. Didn't really listen to anything, though. There's a lot of good stuff on there. He's like, yeah, but you're Scottish. Am I going to put the fucking Rap and Proclaimers on the front cover of Hip Hop Connection? You sound like the fucking Rap and Proclaimers. That is a horrifying thing to say to young rappers. You know?
It's pretty much the antithesis of what you were going for there. Any speeds from Lamborghinis to a car on cobble street. When I got my student loaners at the clubs and getting plastered, I started doing more crazy things than Morrison would have an acid. More vision than Notre Dame, more women and stripper dancers. We got you on the edge of your seat like Chris Tarrant. Bill came to me, we worked at the same place, we worked in a skate store, and he wasn't in for a few days. And then he came in the one day and he said, just got back from London. And I was like, what the fuck are you doing in London? He's like, I went back down, they called me back. When he got down there, they asked him if he'd be okay with rapping in an English accent. I knew that this is what they were like. I knew the industry was like that. I knew that they were building things on pretense and taking balls of clay and making them into what they want to sell, what they think their market and research tells them people want to hear. And I remember sitting him down and I remember saying, like, have you seen The Secret of My Success? The Michael J. Fox movie?
Yeah. And he was like, no. I was like, you should watch that movie because we're going to do that. Basically, we're going to become badass Californian rappers. We're going to become Americans. Immediately, he wasn't like, no, this is crazy. He was like, I've got family in California.
Did you mean we'll go back to some record executives and pretend to be from California and we'll perform for them and then they'll like us because we're not Scottish and then we'll tell them we're Scottish? Or did you mean, let's reinvent ourselves as Californian permanently?
No. We're going to become American. We're going to become everything they want. We're going to become these just unbelievable, sellable machines that everyone wants to be with. Girls want to fuck. Guys want to be like. And we're going to just make the craziest stage show. And we're just going to kick it in everyone's face. We're going to be like 10 times what everyone else is. If there's someone out there that's cool and crazy, we're going to take that and we're going to do it to the ninth degree. We'll get in, we'll get a record deal, we'll launch, it'll go massive overnight, obviously. And then we'll come out and we'll say, we'll go on Jonathan Ross's show, because we're massive fans of Jonathan Ross's show. We'll go on his show and we'll come clean and we'll say, see, talent doesn't have a fucking postcode. Anyone from Scotland can do this. Anyone from Russia can do this. Anyone from anywhere. If you got talent, you got talent. So it was from a kind of point of view of I wanted to be a hero. It wasn't just like, I wanted to be a good guy. I wanted to be the hero. And I wanted to show people, this is how it actually works. And let's fuck over them before they fuck over us, you know, and we can create our own thing.
I mean, it sounds like something you'd say over a pint and then the next day say, yeah, but we're not going to, obviously we're not going to actually do that.
The real truth about it is the next day Bill even remembered it. So a couple of days later at work together in the skate store, I was like, so we need to pick a time and do this. And he was like, are you fucking, what? I thought you were kidding, you know? And then he turned up at my house because he'd just been kicked out of his place from his girlfriend. We had to both be out of options. And then a very close friend of ours, Brian, who was kind of trying to manage us, and he was a really cool friend. He had died. He had a horrible accident where we were playing wrestling outside a pub and he fell on his neck, broke his voice box. Yeah. And that's one of our best friends has died. So everywhere I was walking around, I seen Brian everywhere. And it was like, fuck, I have to get out of this place. Like, I don't want to stay here anymore. So then we probably spent 2 weeks working on re-recording the vocals in American. We stayed in
contact. In American?
Yeah, so we re-recorded.
Talk me through that. I mean, there are many regional accents in the US.
Yeah.
And as you said, hip-hop's all about authenticity.
Yeah.
What voice were you meaning by American?
Bill had picked like a white character who he loved and a black character who he loved. He picked like Chris Rock and he picked Brad Pitt or something like that. Mm. And he tried to mash up the speaking voice with the rapping voice. And I did the same. And mine was Chris Tucker. And I don't know why, but David Schwimmer, I'd watch Jonathan Ross for his American guest. And then I would just like hear everything they're saying. And I'd speak back and I started to mimic and became really good at like getting voices right.
And again, so, I mean, obviously, you know, you could video stuff, but this is the 90s, so there's no YouTube, so you can't just incessantly repeat clips of different people.
We had to record video of people on TV.
So you just watched a lot of David Schwimmer and Michael J. Fox.
Yeah, because Chris Tucker. A lot and
to be clear, I mean, you started obviously practicing on each other, but then you started walking around Dundee.
Yeah, we stayed in character 24/7. It was like, the crazy thing is, we were in character 24/7, we both had girlfriends, and so I'm saying we'd do everything in the American voice. During sex, I'd be talking in an American accent. We did everything. I spoke to my parents. I spoke to everyone in an American accent. And people, I guess, were just like, all right. You know, we used to do that. We used to play characters and joke around with each other. And people would also do it. So we were kind of like that.
Did
so
they understand the plan?
No, no one did. Like,
so they just thought, oh, they're just being weird again.
Yeah.
When did you know that you were ready to go and parade before
we were
a record
totally
executive?
Not ready. There was no being ready. I had entered us in a BBC One Extra competition, one of the new songs I had put up, and it won.
What was the song?
Shut Your Mouth. It got played. Joe Wiley picked it because whoever won it was getting daytime airplay.
Wow.
We were like speaking an American accent, knowing we were going to go sometime soon. And we'd given ourselves a 2-week deadline, which is crazy to become people. But then we started getting phone calls telling us, turn on Radio 1. You know, are people saying, oh my God, I just heard you on Radio 1. For me, it was like, oh, it's definitely on now. Like, this is going to work. This has worked already. And in my head, it was like, this has worked. And it was the final kind of convincing thing for Bill. He was going to do it anyway, but he probably wasn't as confident. Like, I wasn't say I was confident. I was scared. So at that point, it was like, that's it. In the weekend before going to London, like the weekend before, we'd started to try to get shows. We started calling up promoters. Now, before, when we'd called up labels and promoters and managers, couldn't get no one to reply. Couldn't get on the phone for a few minutes even. And now it was all just like getting right through. Oh, who do you want to speak to?
Because of the Radio 1 airplay or because of your accent?
Because of the accent, but also the characters we were playing now was like, hey, We're from the States. We're in town for a little time. So who's your boss? We're touring. We've got radio play on Radio One all week. Who do we talk to? You know, and then they would like put us straight through. There's a different character and confidence when you're playing something that you believe is a winner. You know, like if I'm calling up going, how's it going? I'm Gavin. I'm in a group called, you know, that was the sound. Now, if someone calls me up that like that and says, oh, how's it going? I'm like, fuck off, telemarketers, fuck you. I don't care who it is, do you know what I mean? But to come on the phone and go, what's up? And just take slow everything down and be confident and cool.
Yeah.
It's brainwashing. It fools you into like, oh, God. And yeah, so we managed to get a show. We managed to blag a show at Madame Jojo's. Legendary for its showcases. A music showcase at Madame Jojo's at this time was not like anywhere else. It was always packed with key people, not, you know, junior A&Rs, key people.
Were you worried when you played that first gig that there was a chance someone already knew you from Scotland?
No. The worry was no one's going to buy this. We had managed to set up a meeting with a guy at Sony, and he's Scottish, and we didn't know he was Scottish. We walked in and we're like, you know, all like, you know, shoulders up, stomping around. We sit down and he's like, all right, guys, I saw it. You know, and we're like, oh, fuck, no. What? You know, and if you speak to a Scottish person, when you, it breaks you. It breaks your like your line that you're staying on. And he did. He said something. I can't remember. We always argued about it, but I can't remember who said it. But one of us said I and the other one said Ken. Because it was just so natural at that point from being in Dundee. That you, oh, Ken. Like, but no one else other than Dundonians get that or know that, you know, or, you know, you had to be fully Scottish to get that. So he just stopped as soon as he heard that. He was like, have you toured Scotland? Yeah. He was like, how long have you been here for? As if he was trying to figure out, like, how come you know that terminology? You know, so he was completely blown for us. And this person is now a danger forever. Avoid him like the plague forever. And so then we went to the gig and we started playing. And because we knew we'd fucked up that day, we started playing the characters like so much more. We watched the most boring bands and groups and R&B groups doing this, like singing and dancing together, mostly like R&B groups. But place packed, you know, from the first act. And then we walked backstage and that's where you have your life and your world and it's like turned upside down. Guys and girls backstage getting ready, all in one room. No changing rooms, no dressing rooms, all in one room. Girls getting dressed in front, just completely naked. They were all seasoned, they were all used to it. And so we're just walking around like, what the fuck? Like, Bill's like, this is fucking heaven. You know, but I'm just like, this is fucked up. And I remember seeing at that point, there was a guy who, he came out of a room with a girl and she was like super, 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 super fucking young. No way she was of age. And she was one of the acts performing. And I remember like just thinking like that's fucked up because he just fucked her, you know. But that was so normal to everyone. He's fucked everyone here, and that became something that I saw all the time. But by the time we had to put all that shit over our heads, and by the time we got to go on stage, we're so nervous, but not for the show. The show never nervous about our talent, never that. But who's gonna get what we're doing here? Who's gonna like? What if we mess up the kind of vibe? So we did this crazy stage show, which is like a theater production, chasing each other around with like fake knives, jumping at the crowd, battle rapping people. If you can imagine seeing normal acts the whole night, like to seeing that, it's just like, the fuck is this? And we had no vibe in us that we wanted to be signed. It was like, fuck all of you. We're here. Like, you're honored to be in our presence. Like, now get out of our way, come to the bar and buy us a drink because we were out of money. We need money for drink. You know, that was it. Just buy us booze. And so we jumped off stage, went straight to the bar, got drinks, walked back through the crowd, walked back on stage forward the front way, and then went back just to create an extra bit of thing. And by the time we got back that side, there was a bunch of people who had come around. And it was Chris Rockle from Island Records and I think his pal Dom. And the first thing he said was, where in the States are you from? And immediately I say Huntington and Bill says Hemet. Immediately. And we're like, fuck, we're just so bad at this.
And as a result of that approval from the chap from Island Records, you ended up in the office of Jonathan Shallett, the record manager.
we woke up that next morning thinking that last night was a dream, but we had the business card of Chris Rocco, and he had told us come in at 10:30 and do some of this for everyone. And as soon as we get there, Charlie from Busted walks past us, and like there's a whole bunch of people there. Like Chris Rocco's pulling people out of the office, like, "Yo, come see this!" You know, like it's like, "Guy, everyone, you know, coming into the kind of their big couch area outside their offices in the Island Records." And we just want to sit down, and he's like, "No, no, no!" He's like, "Everyone, you know." And he's like, right, go, do it." And so we just did what the thing we like to do was, all right, we'll just start ripping into everyone. And so we just ripped the fuck out of everyone. Anyone who had like, that was going bald, or like any good looking girls, dudes who had horrible t-shirts, you know, we just start just tearing everyone apart. And the whole time Chris Rock was just like laughing and like killing himself, and people were just like falling over laughing. That was the thing that happened that made everyone talk in the industry. That was the thing that was like, bang. Well, you got to hear these, you know. So when artists are trying to get deals and trying to get something happening, they try to call up a management or call up an A&R, the first thing every A&R does is goes out the window or their door and goes, "Anyone heard of blah, blah, blah? No? Nah, I'm not going to the show." But now if you did that about Syllable and Brains, "Anyone heard of the two Americans?" "Yes! Fuck! Go and see them! Yes! They're the coolest people! Yes!" You know, that's what it was like. We created that on the second fucking day back.
What was your story, though, about why you were in London rather than trying to seek a record deal in California?
That we were on tour and we had a certain amount of money and we spent it all on booze, and now we kind of like London, so we're going to be here boozing for a while.
So just laid back,
yeah.
Skate style.
Yeah, and then as soon as anyone would be like, yeah, so as soon as anyone would be like, "Yeah, but like, so how long?" Is like, "I don't know, man, till the kick is out, who cares?" You know, it was just that vibe. It's like anything that you thought was a pressing question, we'd just be like, we'd have to, even though our inside were going, "Oh my God, they're onto us, they're onto us." Our reaction to that would be like, "I don't fucking know, man. I don't care. I'm tired. I'm hungover. Who cares? Why do you think about this stuff?"
I mean, this would not be possible nowadays, would it, with the internet? There'd be no way of covering up the fact that there'd be footage of you in Scotland being yourselves.
It was not possible then. We just did it. It was impossible because even though the internet exploded when we went on TV, even though people came out the woodworks, even though our best friends were, our ex-girlfriends were in restaurants that we were at with A&Rs, and even though all this stuff was happening, our whole vibe was, we'll make it work. And as soon as you have that main state, like, fuck it.
So you did sign a record deal.
Yeah. So the manager we got, his first thing was to get us to sign to Sony US. So he called over Dave Massey. Dave Massey, the CEO of Sony US, flew over to see us in a rehearsal. How about that for causing a worldwide buzz to get the CEO of Sony to fly from the US? But we didn't understand that because Jonathan Shalit is trying to get us signed back in our hometown, you know? And so this guy comes over, he wanted to sign us. But we then had to get over it because we didn't have passports. Now we're turning down record deals.
That's kind of cool, though.
There was a connection
so
there.
So Jonathan Shalit was able to go to other record labels and say, they've turned down Island Records and they've turned down Sony US.
Yeah. And so Sony UK were, fuck if anyone else is getting this over us. But also there was the storyline of being best friends with Eminem. And that was something that kind of just happened.
What do you mean there was the storyline?
It was manufactured.
You mean a lie?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
You came up with another lie that you were friends with Eminem.
Well,
why?
People kept saying, like, you guys are so much like Eminem. Or, like, this is like Eminem times two. Like, this is phenomenal. You guys must know him, right? And we were like, mm-hmm. Yeah. You get a little bit more drunk, and you're like, so tell me about, cause that's all people want. As soon as you say yes to that, that's all people want to talk about.
Sure.
All hit us, the first 3 months was all like crazy nights out, spreading lies about ourselves, spreading rumors. And I remember being in the Crowbar. It was a place in Soho. I remember being there just heading out, just getting drunk with some friend. And over my shoulder against the wall, this side, is two A&Rs talking about Syllable and Brains. And they're talking about, you know, Eminem's friends, Syllable and Brains. You've heard them. They're on records with him. Oh, yeah. Oh, no, they used to kill it in sessions with him. And this guy's making up the story.
Wow.
And I started to realize everyone would make up stories off of the little bit we'd give them because they all want to be cool with Eminem and they want to be cool with us. And that's their link to superstardom.
But it's sort of easier if you're cynical about the industry to take their money, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't give a fuck. I wanted to get in, get that money. I wanted to get stardom. I wanted to see it, and then I wanted to tear it down.
So how much had been spent on you by this point? You're 3 months in. You've signed a record contract. Yeah. They're paying for your expenses, I guess.
The publishing deal was $70,000 each. Then the record deal was $50,000, $50,000, and $150,000. So it was in stages. So you finished the first song, second song, and then, okay, now you've got an album. It constantly releases more money to you, which is good because we would have probably spent the amount we did faster. And advances, publishing advances, we had around about $250,000. But then we had the John Soda endorsement, Harley endorsement, Vans endorsement, massive endorsements from people. And the reason we're getting all those endorsements is that we're going into the offices and we're meeting Americans who work in the offices in London. And they're like, oh, bro, high-fiving. And it's like, we just light up rooms anywhere we go. And the people would be like, oh, yeah, God, these guys are going to be the world's biggest thing.
Did you feel a bit guilty, though? I mean, I get that you didn't feel bad about taking their money, but did you feel in any way responsible for the fact that in each of these companies, there are people, good people who I guess you met and liked, who think you're American, who've bought into something. Their job is to work with someone, you, and you're not who you say you are.
The reason I didn't feel guilty and the reason it spawned me on further is because I blamed the industry. The one thing I came to realize, because I've got so many friends in it who are just people at companies, they're just doing their job. They're not a part of the... It's the people at the very top and the layers down. At A&R level, of a head of video, that level, these are just good people. And they were phenomenal fun to have drinks with. And, you know, completely broken industry. No one does their fucking job right. It's an insane industry. Very bad for women. But it's a horrifying industry. But most of the time, you will just meet great people. You know, and you'll be able to have a great time. So we had such a great time, but I didn't feel bad because I felt, fuck you. Fuck this industry. Look what you did to me. Look who I have to be. Look how much I have to go through just to get in the door because I'm from Scotland.
But look at the time scale. Because your initial idea, presumably, the way you've told it.
Oh, the timing of this is all off, man.
Right. So exactly. Pretend to be American, get a record deal, put the record out, tell the truth. You're 3 months in, there's no record, you're still American, you have to live the lie all the time. Did you think this is getting ridiculous?
We had no idea about when you come to put a record out, you have to do almost 6-7 weeks lead press. We had no idea of that. Mm. So when we had our single and it went around, there's a street team thing. All these people know about you. Street team's like 500 people strong at times.
What's a street team?
A street team, like a label, has all these fans who get free stuff and the fans work for, you know, they're the voice of the groups and they really champion the groups and they go out and they spread it at all the venues and they're really your key to getting a big fan base. And if you understand them, you can grow your own fan base really well. If you're good with the street team, who you should be because they're the really good people, they're the lovers, they're the fans, then you can go real fast. And so the street teams are out there pumping our shit in all different markets that the label didn't even know. At My Chemical Romance gigs, at like the real cool markets, not the crap, not the hip hop shows. The hip hop show was too limited. So we're out there, and then radio is 48 of 50 DJs on mainstream radio is saying that Cellobone Brains have ticked it like number one hit success on all the feedback. Because when a vibe's big, then they go to MTV, and MTV's like, yeah, MTV picks us for the top six artists projected for the next few years, and it was Bloc Party, Natasha Bedingfield, and a few others, but every single one who was on that have headlined festivals worldwide.
And you.
And then there was us. We didn't understand it. Oh, God, now we're going to have to go on MTV every day. Bang, websites light up.
With people saying, these guys are Scottish.
What the fuck are Gavin Bell doing? Like, are people who had fights with us, a guy that had a fight with in a chip shop in Dundee with my ex, he goes on and he's like, I punched him with my own fist. He's Scottish.
Yeah. Eminem does not get that feedback.
Yeah.
Silly Bill. Grandson, I see you have mastered the style of no style. Yes. My style is Tong Kong Fu.
So the next thing that happened was sitting down with our lawyer, and he started to have some questions because he actually needs to know certain things, and he actually is looking at deals that doesn't have our real names written on them.
Yes.
And so he starts asking, he's like, I'm going to need to see your passports. This nothing is quite adding up here. You've signed publishing endorsements, record deals with these character names, right? They're character names. Your real name's not Brainsville Hood. You're not Syllable, right? I need to know your real names. And we didn't expect that, so we're given a whole bunch of shit. We're also a bit too cocky at that point. We didn't understand his power, so we're a bit like, fuck. Oh, we tried to do that whole, dude, like, I'm fucking hangover. Like, what do you think about this stuff for? And it's like, because I'm a fucking lawyer. And I'm your lawyer. I'm attached to this. So what are you doing? I think I know what you're doing. And if it is true, you are going to go to jail and you're going to have to pay all this money back. And I hope you've got $1 million just sitting around. And we came out of that meeting like, we cannot release this record. Everything at that point was like, shut it all down, slow it down, stall. And Bill didn't want to. And that was the real start of the first break of decision making. We can't bring this record out. This motherfucker is not joking. Like, we will be sued. We will go to jail. This is real fraud. It's not a jokey fraud. This is real fraud. You know, like, we will go to jail.
It's kind of unprecedented as well, isn't it? I mean, you think about music scandals like that, and the closest you come is, you know, Milli Vanilli or, you know, the lead singer of Black Box or something, and it's not their real voice or their miming or... But those are record company interventions. They're not the artist defrauding the record company.
Well, that's the whole point of the story, was to show... The whole point was to say, make yourself a brand, become, like, the monster, but know who you are still. Don't lose yourself. The problem is, we're in there, now a year half in... And we're a punk rock band. Now we've become so many other characters. We've convinced the label to give us enough money to record 6 albums. We recorded 6 albums. And Sony's just dishing that money out because new A&R gets put in, doesn't understand the story. Just, okay, cool. Okay, the money.
You recorded 6 albums before you'd released a single?
No single came out. And so by the time it came up to BMG, so we're on the label for a year, 2 years. And because A&R's jobs go every few months, like someone loses their job, moves on. So when they merged with BMG, everyone was starting to take stock. And that's the thing with a big corporation. No one keeps track of anything. No one asked us in the label or the management group. No one asked us who the fuck you really are.
Mm.
What's your real name? We sign on documents our false names. Mm. And everything we were trying to do to stop the record coming out, like we did a song called Cunt, thinking no one's going to play that. No one is going to play that. And it was about George Bush Jr. And the whole song has cunt through it 300 times.
Mm.
And the chorus is, George Bush, you are a cunt. He's a cunt. George Bush, you are a cunt. He's a cunt.
This was now a deliberate strategy to not release the record.
Yeah, everything we're doing now is...
Because the moment it gets released, you'll get found out.
We're done. So everything we're doing now is to bring us
down.
So
what's the point now?
But Syllable doesn't...
No, what is the point?
Well, the point is...
You can't expose... it. The point was to expose the record industry.
But, and I said, like, a whole
point is...
Do you
just enjoy the lifestyle at this point?
Yeah, don't become the monster. Or we were the monsters now. We had become... We were full in, 100% full in. And I was full in, but I was rationalizing to myself that you're a spy, you're a separate agent, you're on something important here, you know? And Bill was like, the monster was like, nah, I'm the star. It doesn't matter what we've done. Let's release the record, you know. So we were splitting that way, but there's no way they're going to put this out. And so it was right. Cunt didn't got banned from all radio, all commercial radio, but then it goes to uni radio, becomes a massive success. Becomes like a keeps Boyzone off uni radio. He's a cunt, George Bush, you are a cunt. He's a cunt, George Bush, you are a cunt. He's a cunt, George Bush, you are a cunt.
I'm going to jump straight to my favourite part of this story, which is when you end up supporting D12.
Yeah.
So you've pretended that you are friends with them.
For about like 12, 13 months that we're best friends with them, yeah.
When you heard that that was happening, what were you feeling?
I was so tired because we had just done 40 days of tours, and that most of that was a uni tour, and I broke my leg on the first couple nights. So I was just like, no, I'm not touring anymore. You know, you think you want to tour your whole life. You're like, oh, what is tour? Go do 40 days. See how you feel. And I was broken. I was just like, fuck, I cannot do another Sure. And then we get back. And now at this point, we're a punk rock band. There's five of us. And everyone's in it. The punk, they all know. You know, they're all in it.
What do you mean everyone's in on it?
We've told them. Eventually.
Your band know that you're Scottish. Yeah. But the record label don't.
The record label don't. And it's only, it's like three other guys. One best friend from South Africa, two from Scotland. So they were very solid with the lie. But so we get back and we crash down. Head hits the pillow. Phone call on the mobile. It's Dell from Charlotte's office. And he's like, good news and bad news. Bad news is you're not coming off the road. I'm like, Del, no. And he's like, good news is Eminem's taking you on the road. I was just like, oh no. You know, and then he kept saying, he's like, D12 tour starts tonight. You'll be picked up in a couple of hours. Maybe get a couple of hours sleep. I ran downstairs and I'm like, fuck! You know, and I'm telling everyone, D12 are taking us on the road. And everyone's like, that's fucking amazing. It's like, think about it. It's not amazing. Everyone's going to be there. They're going to see us not knowing them. How is it amazing?
You what was the venue? Over. Brixton Academy.
Brixton was the first night, yeah. On the tour bus over, Bill and I were sitting in the back, sweating. This is over now. You know when you're past panicking, you're like bottomed out. You're like kind of almost delirious. So your energy's gone. That's how I felt. And we're standing, we get there and we go at the side of the stage and they're on stage sound checking. And it's like, there is no God. Like you would not do this to us, you know? And then, there's our A&R, there's our publisher, all coming along to, you know, they have to turn up then, you know, just to see, oh, the uniting of the best friends, you know. As they finish sound checking, Bill and I just do what we always did, dig deep, walk on, and become legends. And we just walked up to them, high-fived, grabbed them, held them tight, you know, so they couldn't get away from us, and just, like, pretended we were best friends with them. And I guess them just being good guys, nice guys, obviously thinking like, oh, well, maybe we know these guys. They just were like, all right, cool. Luckily, Eminem wasn't there right then. But as soon as he came on the tour, he was jumping in and off at nights. The problem for us was we can't be around this motherfucker. We're spending most of the time trying to duck God. All we want to do is hang out with him and say we're the same as you. But we're fucking trying to duck him. And eventually, Proof manages to get us in a situation where we're all together and
so
it's all good.
Did you manage to make D12 think that they had met you before in California?
Yeah.
How?
They thought at the moment on stage that they must have met us. But by the time the management and everything went away, the tour just develops. We're just shooting the shit, do you know what I mean? So by the time everyone came back, we were pretty good with them.
I mean, it's an extraordinary journey, obviously, to go from being a hip-hop fan in Dundee.
Bedroom to touring with the greatest.
To spitting with D12.
Yeah.
But the thing you liked about hip-hop was authenticity. Here you are pretending.
Yeah.
That must have caused a strain in you.
It
Never
did.
Mind the fact the lie might be outed.
Yeah.
How did you feel?
It caused pain. My whole thing has always been, like, I'm trying to simply just do the thing I love at all costs. And I learned that, no, there doesn't have to be a cost. And that was the thing that taught me. You have to understand, as someone who came from trauma, who had no confidence, sometimes you have to become other people to see who you really are. And that's kind of what I felt that I did.
It must have been hard to remember who you were if you're in character
the whole
time.
I lost who I was, 100%. I didn't know the guy who I was after a while. There's something that's really interesting about it is that when you're young, you have this playful, there's two people. There's you who's just talking and thinking, and then there's a child or the playful, happy thing inside that wants to be happy. That will become someone else if you don't let it keep being happy. So what we do through our lives is that we ignore the happy child inside and we bury them down. We don't stay with the girl who makes us happiest because she's not hot enough. So we go with the hot one. The hot one tears our fucking hearts apart. We don't do the thing we love because it doesn't make us money. So we bury it down. That person, that child becomes an angry, jaded, annoyed human who just does what everyone else wants. And so it buries itself down. And when you need someone to give you good ideas and when you need someone to feel fun and happy when you're feeling low, it's like, fuck you. I'm down here drowning in your sorrows because you chose that route. So I didn't choose that route. So while the outside person became all these different people, just playing, just scared, just being someone else, just being whoever the fuck made me feel like great, he was still having fun. He was still there. The child inside was still having the greatest time.
How did the adventure end?
It hasn't. I'm still on it.
But it didn't end with you on the Jonathan Ross show saying, hey, we're Scottish.
No. The Syllable and Brains adventure ended. Let's just say it got very poisonous
towards each other. People were offering
between you and
us,
Bill.
Yeah, labels were trying to sign us separately. People were offering us so much different stuff. We almost killed each other, and then he was gone. And then I was left with 50 grand debt.
He was gone as in he went back to Scotland?
Just bolted. So then I was...
And you were a double act. You were a duo.
Yeah. But the greatest thing about that was, here is the way out. The contract was void. We're out. I didn't know that at the time. I was still trying to make it happen. We had to play Reading Festival and stuff. So I was trying to make all these things happen still. And I was still like attached to this. Like, no, we can't go back. I can't go back. I'm a failure if I go back like this. Like, we have to do this. And I, you know, but I was still on a destructive path. I became so many other people. I've lived this character for 5 years, and it took best friends to die of cancer. It took best friends, like childhood sweetheart, to die of liver cancer, to people who knew me to the core since I was four. People who knew me to pass, for me to snap the fuck out of it. My childhood sweetheart, she'd passed away. The last thing I ever said to her on the phone before she died was, she promised me to never give up music. And I had said, I'm not giving up music. I had totally given up music. And I said, no, I'm not giving up music. You know, I'm starting a new band. And I just lied immediately to her. You know, and then she died a couple of days later. And it was the last thing I said to the person I loved was a lie. And so that, for me, I've told a person a deliberate lie since that day, since 2007. So after I kind of had an overdose, strangely, when people die in my life, I get reinvigorated somehow. It's because I think, like, fuck, they died. I can't sit around moaning, pissing and moaning, you know? And so I created a band. And another friend, only 3 or 4 months later, a friend of mine called Ivan, who I had known since a kid as well, he was dying. And I was like, fuck no, I'm not going to let him die. So I put a show together, and I was going to raise all this money by my comeback. We still had so many fans, still had so many people wanted to sign these American rappers and stuff. So I put a show together, and I was going to use all their money to pay for his cancer treatment. And as I was at the side of the stage, my best friend Rob had got text through saying, Ivan's passed. He's not making it. So I'm standing at the side of the stage, my new band's on stage, behind a drum kit, playing a guitar riff, playing bass. And I said to Rob, like, I can't go on stage because I'm still this character. And I said to him, I can't go on stage. And he's like, fuck, get the fuck on stage. And I was like, I don't know who to be. Like, who do I be? You know, and then he was like, just go on stage. The best thing he ever said to me was like, go on stage and be who Ivan knew, be who Sky knew. Go and be that guy. So I walked on stage and I told everyone to stop the music. And I just started talking and I slowly dropped the accent. And I started to kind of talk in rhyme, moaning about things, but angry. Unknown where the anger came from. I didn't know what to do. I was like freaking out. My mind was exploding in front of people on stage. And I started to do like this rhyme where I'm just like trying to talk about things. I'm trying to find a way of saying, I'm not who you think I am. And eventually I managed to get there. And then the last few things I said before we actually did play a song was, I'm not Brains McLeod. I'm Gavin Bain. I've never been to America. Then we went into a song, and it wasn't till I did a moment of silence halfway through that where I heard a person, someone in the crowd going, oh, I think that's his real voice. You know, and it was like, it started to sink in. It was an odd moment, but the pressure dropped off me. And I remember coming off stage and people coming up and some people being like, why'd you lie to me though? I would have been able to go with it. You could have told me. And that was the big vibe. It wasn't like, oh, you fucking liar.
The moral from all of this, if you were being tried, if this was the Hollywood version, would be that the moment you were honest and became yourself, as you say, the weight lifted, you felt better. But is that true, really? I mean, the experiences you had.
It's not as simple as that. But what I would say is that you have to take the journey. It's the hero's journey. You fucking have to. I had to go on this journey, become the potential of, because he's just the potential of my personality. So I had to meet him and reach certain things and see how bad he could be, see how good he could be, and see how far he could go, see what I could do. And in learning on that journey, there was going to be a crash. There was going to be a fall. And then after the fall, after the pain comes real truth, it comes real glory. You can't run from the pain. People spend their whole lives trying to run from pain. And what I learned was, I mean, I was desperately scared of losing things, but I was running toward chaos. You know, there was something inside. It was just like, let's go, let's see where it goes. And after taking the whole arc, you come out at the end like, oh, okay, I'm a better person.
And now you're a bit more mature. You can acknowledge that the Proclaimers are quite cool.
They've always been good.
They've been a good act for a while.
It's just that every time it comes to the end of a night of a club, you know, and the, ah, well, walk, I'm like, fuck yeah! You guys don't understand my pain, man!
Gavin Bain. He's got a book out featuring even more of his story. It's called California Scheming. And if you want to hear some more Syllable and Brains, well, you can, because all their records are on Spotify, released by Gavin personally, even though Sony paid for all the recording sessions, the contracts were signed under false names. If you've got a story you'd like to hear on The Modern Man, then do be in touch via the feedback form on our website, modernman.co.uk. Alex Fox is up next, after this.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And from hip-hop to boff-boff, it's time for The Foxhole with Alex Fox. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Ollie. It's lovely to see you, and I hope that you are glowing more brightly than the firefly's bottom today.
We're here to talk about sex. Before we do, we should ask you what you've been up to this week, Alex.
I have just returned from Latvia, where I managed to successfully get 3 vibrators, 60 condoms, and a stainless steel G-spot probe through Stansted Airport. Win for me.
Well done. So obviously, customs is different in Latvia to Dubai.
Yes, thankfully. We really must talk about what sex toys you're allowed to take where in a future episode. But for now, I was in Riga, the capital of Latvia, for the Digital Freedom Festival, where I was talking about the future of intimacy and introducing people to a number of new terms, including muffing.
Go on.
Muffing is a relatively new term, and it refers to the insertion of a finger, usually a finger, although I suppose you could use another tool, into the inguinal canal. It's the gap inside a gentleman's abdomen from which his testicles have descended. So there are some people who are gaining pleasure by rubbing their fingers, or someone else's fingers, up and down this inguinal canal.
Why would you give it the same name as a slang word for a lady's parts, then?
What, the muffing bit?
Yes.
I don't know the etymology of the word, but I do know that there are many people who define as trans women who are doing this. So people who have the gender identity of a woman but who still possess bollocks are experimenting with this particular sexual practice.
Okay, so perhaps a deliberate blurring of the genital lines there.
Yeah, maybe. And there are two reasons why they're doing it. Partly because it can feel really nice. There's a nerve located inside that space, which, let me check my pronunciation here, it's called the ilioinguinal nerve, which happens to be very, very close to another nerve called the genitofemoral nerve. And stimulating one can stimulate the other and provoke pleasure. So that's a pleasant reason to do it.
And what would the other reason be?
Well, it's a form of penetrating somebody with a penis involving the genitals at the front of their body. So it's sort of a way of approximating a sexual act that somebody with a vagina might enjoy, even if you don't have a vagina yourself.
Every day's an education. Time to move on to our listener question, sponsored as ever by our friends at mycondom.com.
Who've recently added a special category to their website called stocking fillers, which is full of, as the name suggests, things that are suitable for filling stockings. Tiddly-widdly bottles of lube, amaretto-flavoured condoms. They've got these cute condoms that are on the end of lollipop sticks, so they sort of look like sweets. Lots of small things that would easily make good tiny gifts for your loved one.
Great tip. Okay, the question comes from Pip, who says, I have a repulsion to my boyfriend's cum. He is the first and only person I've slept with, and a year or so ago, I started to develop this aversion. I hate the smell, taste, and texture. If I see or smell it, I begin to gag and nearly vomit. I can't really explain why it happens. There isn't a conscious hatred, it's an instantaneous reaction. Even thinking about it now, with no one anywhere near, I feel a bit nauseated. He is very understanding, and I'm happy to say we are able to talk about it. We've also started some workarounds, like always using a condom to keep the cum away from me, but I find I have to leave him to dispose of the condoms, as I can't even hear him remove it without feeling queasy. I find myself getting quite scared when cuddling that his naked penis might touch me and get some on me. He's admitted to me that it makes him feel a bit sad, because although he understands that I can't help it, it doesn't make him feel very attractive. So, Alex, is this a common problem? And what can I do to make him feel appreciated, even when I feel too ill to touch him?
Okay, so here we have a woman who really can't bear to come anywhere near her boyfriend's cum. Mm. Now, there are lots of people out there who don't actively adore the smell, taste or texture of semen.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm sure you don't have the data to hand, but I think it's probably fair to say maybe even the majority of people don't actively like it.
There are definitely those
there are
out
some
there
who do
fetishise
sure.
it. Yes,
probably
yes,
the majority don't.
Some people quite literally lap it up.
Sure.
But yeah, there are plenty of people who aren't mad for it, let's say. However, I do think that the issue described here has gone further than that. Mm. I think we're approaching the territory, or in fact, we're well into the territory of an active phobia here. It's actively making her feel ill, and she is scared of it. You know, she's saying things like laying next to her partner when he's naked are making her feel frightened. Mm. We're not given any background information on where this fear may have come from and this aversion, but it's not too much of a stretch of imagination to think that perhaps if when you were younger you heard something about HIV or STIs being transmitted via semen, that could grow in your mind to become a bigger fear than it needs to be. Of course, it's semen that can get people pregnant, and if you're a woman who's worried about pregnancy, then that can escalate within your psyche. Mm. But thankfully, there are lots of ways for this to be tackled that don't involve her partner feeling ashamed of what comes out of his tackle, because that worries me here. It's brilliant that her boyfriend is helping her with these workarounds, but if this carries on, there's a chance that he will start to feel ashamed of his own body, worried about very normal sex acts in a way which is not great for him either.
And also, if they do end up trying for a baby, he will have to come in her, as you suggest. That is how that works.
Yeah, she doesn't say whether she might want biological children in the future, but obviously this is going to have to be a phobia that she overcomes if she's going to do that in any kind of straightforward way. There's lots and lots of options for help here, though. I spoke to my friend Sarah Berry, who is a fantastic sex specialist therapist, and she said the fact that the writer here hasn't described to us why she thinks she is so afraid of semen might indicate that she hasn't worked it out herself yet. Mm. Going to see a therapist and exploring the possibilities of what's caused this in the first place can help her to understand what's happening and also calm down about it.
Because I mean, you're right, it does seem like it is just the very concept of it that's freaking her out, but equally it's the smell, it's the taste. And so that makes you think, well, was there contact with semen that she's either forgotten about or chosen to forget about, which, you know, could be causing this?
This is a bit of a chicken and egg problem, really, isn't it? Because we don't know whether in her mind she, for example, might have become overly frightened of semen because she thinks it's going to result in an unwanted pregnancy, and therefore the qualities of semen, like the scent of it, have become distasteful to her, or whether there has been something happened in her life where that she's associated that scent with having a bad time, and then that fear, that distaste has expanded to include other qualities of that particular liquid. Certain forms of therapy, like Sarah's, might begin by sitting down and talking about where this problem had come from, and then very, very, very gradually working out potential ways of slowly introducing exposure to the offending, frightening substance, i.e. semen. Those exercises might look like, for example, laying naked with her partner whilst she has a towel over her genitals or over as much of her body as she feels comfortable with, so that she is the one in control, and then gradually removing that towel so they've got skin-to-skin contact, act, as it's taken entirely at her own pace. There's no pressure on her for this to be a sexual act. It's all about just becoming more comfortable with laying together.
What else could she do if she doesn't want to go and see a therapist about this? You know, I mean, perhaps you're right that it is that serious, but what if she doesn't think it is?
There's really nothing that can be done about a phobia that doesn't involve actively confronting it one way or another. In this instance, I would very strongly suggest finding a professional that suits you and an approach that appeals to you and dealing with it professionally. Mm. I think there are exercises that the couple can do together. There are perhaps mindfulness exercises that she can do on her own. But if it's reached the stage where she can't even hear a condom being removed without that causing her emotional distress, then I really think it's time to involve a professional. I spoke to a hypnotherapist called Desmond O'Connor, brilliantly. Now, the difference between hypnotherapy and more traditional talking therapies, which might appeal to our writer, is that hypnotherapy doesn't require you to be gradually exposed to the thing that makes you phobic. In theory, you can have sometimes just one, but sometimes more, sessions of hypnotherapy and be cured without needing to go through that process of working out why something's upsetting you and then exposing yourself to it in very small doses.
Yeah, although different hypnotherapists have different ways of approaching those
things too, don't they?
Some of them will want to regress you and take you back to whatever it was. But the thing is, with hypnotherapy, you're essentially just changing the way you think about that thing. I mean, to take the no smoking example, you're saying, I think of a cigarette as smelling like shit and then you don't want to put it in your mouth. It's that in reverse, isn't it? Presumably, it's changing the way you think about semen so you think it tastes delicious, essentially.
I doubt it's going to make it taste like a roast dinner.
No, but you put positive associations where there were negative associations.
This is true. I'm now thinking about Walker's Crisps and their, you know, every year they do their new
semen
flavors.
And Lineker. Yeah.
So it deals with the unconscious rather than making things conscious. That might be something to explore. Another option is neuro-linguistic programming, or NLP. Use a sort of language-based games to reframe the way that somebody thinks about something. So a typical exercise might involve an NLP practitioner guiding our reader through a session by imagining that, say, she's in a cinema in the third row watching herself have an experience in which she's freaking out over semen. She might imagine that she can turn down the volume on the sound, maybe put another soundtrack over the top that's comical, turn it into a funny joke so she can laugh at it. And by playing with the situation that way, by manipulating the way she thinks about it, it is theoretically possible to change her view so that when that then happens in real life, her associations are positive and joyful and hopeful rather than frightened and tense and concerned. Perhaps the couple here might want to attend therapy as a twosome. They may want to approach this together. It's also a really good idea to have in place a plan B for if you're going to embark on any exercise like this in the bedroom together. Make sure that you have a plan in case something goes wrong. So if you do reach a stage where you're feeling uncomfy, you need to take a time out. It might be good to have discussed that beforehand, and maybe the lady here can just go and make a couple of cups of tea. The guy can maybe pop and have a shower or something that they have already discussed, so that in the instance that something does feel uncomfy, that's not a scenario that becomes even more frightening because you feel like you've failed or you feel like something's gone terribly wrong.
Excellent stuff. Thank you, Alex. If you have a question of sex for Alex Fox, what do you need to do with it?
Head on over to our website, which is modernmanwith2ns2fortheprice of1.co.uk, and click feedback.
And if you want to find Alex on the internet,
you
are
there.
Oh,
please do find me. I'm on Instagram at Alex Fox, AlixFox. The same on Twitter. And especially in the run-up to Christmas, I'm working with lots of brands to offer tasty discounts.
And speaking of discounts, if you want 15% off your choice of condoms and lube and stocking fillers from mycondom.com, then all you need to do is use our code
FOXHOLE.
Well, that is very nearly it for this week's Modern Man, but there is just time to anoint a new Manbassador. It is Holly in Canada who says, Ollie, I found your show at the end of season 5 and have now worked my way through your whole back catalogue. I finally matched intention with action and have bought you all a beer as well. is there any chance that you have an ambassador position open for Nova Scotia? Oddly enough, Holly, we do. You are the first Nova Scotian to offer their services, so I am thrilled to pronounce you Manbassador for Nova Scotia. Congratulations. Music now, and our theme is by Django Django from their self-titled debut. And despite our hip-hop theme this week, our record of the week couldn't be any more different. This is Van Morrison with the opening track from his 38th studio album. It's called Broken Record, and it's out now on Caroline International. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer Matt Hill, and we'll see you next Tuesday.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Tuesday, we head to the battlefields of medieval Spain to witness the very first ambulance.
On Wednesday, it's the anniversary of the day Coca-Cola's creator hit on his winning formula. He dropped the wine, but kept the cocaine.
On Thursday, the thief who stuffed the crown jewels down his trousers.
And on Friday, when free-spirited Danish parenting put 90s New York in a tears.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.